The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're looking back at some of the most popular and most heavily debated stories from our Only in New Hampshire series. That's where you send us questions about the state that aren't the kind of things that you can Google, and we send our producers out to investigate and come back with answers. Executive producer Erica Janik and senior producer Taylor Quimby are with me to introduce these stories and talk a little bit about what went into them and how they were received. Hello, Erica.
Howdy.
Hey, Taylor. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So we're starting with one of your stories from our very last show of 2017.
That's right. We got a question from a listener that ended up being the basis for pretty much the whole New Year's Eve show. It's a delightfully simple sounding question with a rather complicated answer. So what was your Only New Hampshire question?
Basically, just why are liquor laws so weird in New Hampshire?
We called it the boozy show, for the record.
The booze show. Yeah, we did.
I'm new to New Hampshire, and I thought this was a very telling episode.
What, do you think our liquor laws are weird?
They do seem rather weird. I was really surprised that there are no bars in New Hampshire. And one of the first things I noticed about New Hampshire were all of the big roadside liquor stores. Like the moment you cross the border, it's like, come buy our liquor. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Well, even though we ended up talking about just a handful of liquor laws, Taylor focused on one in particular that our Only in New Hampshire listener found especially confusing. So let's play the story.
Sam Pinkasic looks hip enough to hang out at a Brooklyn bar, but he's New Hampshire enough to show up to the NHPR studios in a t-shirt, even though it's below freezing. Maybe he hasn't bought a new jacket since he moved back from San Diego.
The bars out there, like, I really got into the craft cocktail scene out there because there's a lot to experience. I mean, it's a city. You're going to have a lot more options.
Sam and his wife moved back to the state in May. They bought a house in Mount Vernon. Sam works remotely, so he spends a lot of his days hanging out at a place called Union Coffee Company in Milford, just one town south. They've got craft beers, coffee, bands. A friend of his owns the place.
And, yeah, I was just talking with my friend there about, you know, wondering if they were going to have cocktails on their menu sometime. And he said, it's complicated. And I was like, that's strange. It seems like a simple question.
There's a funny thing about bars in New Hampshire. Technically, there are none. There are only restaurants. Back after Prohibition ended, when the 21st Amendment was ratified in 1933, states were given a choice. They could choose to continue banning liquor sales entirely. They could allow the sale of alcohol by private stores and companies, or they could take over liquor sales themselves, create a state-run monopoly to oversee operations, and collect taxes. About a third of the country chose that last option, including New Hampshire. Today, we call these states control states. There are 17 total, and they all do things a little differently.
Basically, the federal government says it's still illegal. If a state wants to make it illegal, then everything is mother may I. Everything we do is, you know, what we allow.
This is John Hunt, a 16-term Republican state rep from Cheshire County.
So originally, it was thought that the best thing to do when you have alcohol around is that you should have food. And there has always been a food requirement. So there are no bars in New Hampshire. There's no place that all it does is serve a bar like other states.
In other words, after Prohibition ended, legislators didn't want bars or saloons opening up willy-nilly around the state, so they only gave licenses to restaurants. Eventually, they made a more relaxed license for places that wanted to serve beer and wine, but if you wanted to serve the hard stuff, you had to meet the food requirement. And you still do. Today, 50% of sales have to come from food if you want a full liquor license. Or you've got to sell at least $75,000 worth of food every year. The real question is, in a state known for its live free or die attitude, how has this law survived so long?
I'm just mostly curious what the reason is behind it. You know, just it seems kind of strange to try to make sure that people are drinking responsibly by making sure that they can eat food, while at the same time, you know, if it's New Hampshire, we have liquor stores on our highways. It seems kind of strange to me.
Yeah. In truth, the New Hampshire legislature has carved out dozens of exceptions, special liquor licenses that allow establishments to serve or sell booze without food. There's a special license for hotels, for airports, for vessels and train cars. There's even one for alpine slides, a special license that was passed before any alpine slides had actually been built in the state. If you can't get one of these special licenses, the food requirement applies. For real, sit-down, dining room-style pubs and restaurants, that's not an issue. It's your neighborhood dive bars that wind up feeling the pinch.
There's also another bar called Panouche's or something like that in Nashua that both of these have food that to me obviously looks like it's meant to pass a law. Like it kind of looks like top ramen with like some vegetables thrown in maybe. And it's good and it's cheap. You know, it's like, you know, $4 a dish or something, which is great, you know, because the bars are awesome. Like, are they selling $75,000 worth of ramen?
What difference does it make whether you get really drunk on wine or beer and no food, or shots of tequila and food? You know, it really kind of makes no sense. It's all the same drug, you know?
Todd Towsley is the owner of Panouche's Bar. Three of them, actually. He's got one in Keene, one in Concord, and one in Nashua.
I never did get the reason why they have it that way, but they still have it on the books.
Todd bought his Keene Bar in 1990, an old neighborhood dive off the main drag. And back then, he made do with just the beer and wine license. But over the years, as more and more restaurants started to pop up, competition forced him to upgrade. He wanted to be able to sell liquor. So he converted an old closet into a kitchen, got a deep fryer, and made up a menu. But Todd told me that didn't really change the basic facts.
Yes, people come in and eat my food, but in reality, for so many years, it was just kind of like a beer hangout place that most people really look at us as a place they want to go and have a few drinks and watch the game. So it doesn't really make us a restaurant just by having a kitchen.
So how does the Liquor Commission feel about it?
I don't get the everyday feeling that the State Liquor Commission is out to enforce this rule particularly heavy. They're more concerned about underage drinking and over-intoxication, which is important to us out in the field as well.
In New Hampshire, the Liquor Commission doesn't make laws. They enforce them. And yes, they do come up with their own guidelines. Joe Malika is chairman of the New Hampshire Liquor Commission.
Now, we don't go in and tell people that, you know, we're not in the business to say what is food. Is a jar of pickled pig's feet and deviled eggs at the end of the bar food? Well, technically it is. And if you meet your requirements, it's something that we're, I don't want to say, there's a certain amount of leniency.
One bar owner told me, as long as you make a good faith effort, as long as you look like you're selling food, the Liquor Commission doesn't really care. Another told me that the food requirement is used to put pressure on so-called problem bars that are too rowdy. For example, the now-defunct Club Liquid in Manchester. In 2005, Club Liquid got busted for a few different violations, failing to train employees, over-serving customers, but it was the food requirement that led the Liquor Commission to downgrade Club Liquid's liquor license. Eventually, the place shut down. Eddie Edwards was chief of liquor enforcement at the time.
It seems on the surface like, okay, well, that place appears to be a bar, not a restaurant.
Edwards told me that the Liquor Commission works with establishments for years sometimes to help them meet the requirements before resorting to enforcement. But he's not a big fan of the law either. When he was with the commission, Edwards even recommended the state do away with the food requirement entirely.
A recommendation that we split the categories, that we actually, you know, we're realistic of what's going on. But there's a lot of tug of war there.
In 2001, Representative Joe Hunt sponsored a bill that would simplify the state's licensing. There are currently more than 50 classifications of retail and on-premise liquor licenses, those special exemptions I mentioned earlier. This bill would have knocked that down to 4. It would have also done away with the food requirement. And in exchange, bars that wanted to serve hard alcohol without grub would have to pay more for their license.
That would be the second time I've tried this. And each time, it was always the Liquor Commission's idea, by the way. And I was sponsoring the bill for the commission that, you know, let's run this up the flag and see what happens.
In public hearings on the bill, one representative asked if it would mean bars didn't have to serve pretzels. The moral argument came up, too. Donald Wharton, then president of Plymouth State College, wrote a letter to the House Ways and Means Committee opposing the bill.
Every college town and many of our city neighborhoods suffer already from the destructive presence of the outlaw bar that serves minors, intoxicated persons, and sends the implicit message that sexual harassment or sexual assault will be tolerated on their premises. Mr. Chairman, this bill will only encourage and proliferate these kinds of socially destructive establishments.
The Liquor Commission testified diplomatically in favor of the bill. Hunt paraphrased their comments with a little more flavor. This legislation, he said, is strongly recommended by the New Hampshire Liquor Commission, who believe that the current laws governing licensing in Title VIII are a complex labyrinth constructed more to accommodate new and evolving businesses than an orderly and efficient licensure structure for businesses selling alcoholic beverages. So what ended up happening with the bill in 2002?
All those bills have died. Yes, they died. They're dead.
Eddie Edwards and Chairman Joe Mollica both told me that one of the reasons the food requirement stays in place is because of all the restaurants who have already had to comply.
Yeah, so my name is Mike Summers. I'm the president and CEO of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association.
As far as I can tell, the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association was technically in favor of the 2002 bill. Their lobbyist was marked in the pro camp on documents about the hearings. Still, Mike explained why restaurants might be in favor of the status quo.
You know, a lot of these guys, because of the food requirement, have already invested a significant amount of time, effort, and resources in the way of kitchen equipment, kitchen staff, inventory for their kitchens, you know, food storage equipment, et cetera. And when you roll it all up, it's a pretty significant amount of money.
There's a sort of inertia to these old laws. If you change them, it's easier for up-and-comers than it was for the old-timers.
You're essentially going to have a bunch of bars pop up around the state that are going to directly compete with these restaurateurs who have been forced to put in all this equipment and all this capital investment. And, you know, now exactly what do they do without losing that investment?
As it turns out, this isn't a rhetorical argument. Sam, who asked us about the food requirement in the first place, he's actually got some skin in the game.
I love craft cocktails, so I would actually be interested in maybe opening up a tiny cocktail bar in the future, but I don't think I want to go through the trouble of opening up a whole kitchen and restaurant, you know? So for me, that's inhibiting me from opening a business.
I told Todd Towsley at Panucci's about Sam's dilemma. To be a successful entrepreneur, he said, you can't be scared of the rules.
Man, don't be afraid. Just find the rules, make yourself a kitchen, you know, try to do it right, and open your cocktail bar. Don't be afraid. You'll have what you need. Just go for it.
And Sam, if all else fails, you can always get a special license and put your cocktail bar at the top of an alpine slide. Or in a train car. Or in a hotel. Or on an airship. Or in a ballroom. Or in a vessel. Or in bed and breakfast.
That was senior producer Taylor Quimby for Only in New Hampshire. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored.
So the food requirement that we just heard about isn't going anywhere, as far as I know. But later in the show, I did this rapid-fire question round with the chairman of the Liquor Commission, Joseph Mollica, and I asked him this. Is it true that musicians, performers, that they can't drink while they're doing those things on stage at a pub or a bar or something like that?
That's true. And
does this apply to, like, open mic nights and that sort of thing?
Or if you pass around a hat?
Chairman Mollica told me that it doesn't apply if you're not being paid. But, you know, I talked to some folks who just generally found this whole thing confusing and venues that told me, you know, they stay away from it and they wouldn't let even a free performer who's doing an open mic night have a drink because they just don't want to deal with it.
I thought that was one of the perks.
You would think. Regardless, New Hampshire House just passed a bill that would exempt entertainers and dancers from the law that says employees can't drink while working. That bill that passed is now going to the Senate. And to learn more, I actually caught up with the House rep that put the bill forward, who it just so happens is also in a band called Skin Drone.
So my name is Brandon Finney. I'm a state rep for Rochester Wards 4 and 5. That's Stratford 24. And I am one of three state reps in the Libertarian Party in this state. My goal, as I've been in office, is just to get rid of old unenforceable laws that have no real bearing on modern times, that really have no practical enforceability, and I've gotten a couple bills passed being able to tackle kind of dumb stuff, and you know, not just because it's dumb, but because we're trying to minimize, you know, the amount of power that the government has over small insignificant things.
So why did you introduce the bill?
Well, as someone that's been in the music scene for a long time, and I know a lot of promoters and people that have done a lot of shows, and I guess we're one of the only states that actually enforces this law. The argument that I made was that if you hire a band, you know, for your pub or, you know, the restaurant or whatnot, like, you're not signing hiring paperwork, you're not doing a W-4 or an I-9, and, like, you know, you're not on a payroll system. You're kind of like, hey, like, come out and play for my patrons, and then I'll pay $100 or whatever, you know. And you know, funny enough, in the Commerce Committee, where the bill had first been heard, the Liquor Commission actually came in and supported it, and I was kind of surprised by that. And I think the reason why is because they don't have the manpower to enforce it. I think, you know, kind of having their stamp of approval on it, it'll be easier to pass, you know, through the Senate. So I'm hoping it'll cross the governor's desk pretty soon here, and then we can get rid of this stupid law.
That was State Rep Brandon Finney of Skin Drone, we might add, who put forward a bill to exempt performers from a law prohibiting drinking on the job. Taylor, this was a very only in New Hampshire kind of update.
Yeah. I thought of a good headline opportunity. Millennial libertarian politician / metalhead fights to drink while slaying on the guitar.
I would totally click on that. Coming up, more of our favorite only in New Hampshire stories when word of mouth continues. Welcome back. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. And today we're going full circle on some of our most popular stories from the Only in New Hampshire series. That's where we answer your questions about the state, or in the case of the next story, about pizza. Our EP, Erica Janik, is here, along with Jimmy Gutierrez, who produced this story. Hey, Jimmy.
Ahoy there.
The pirate thing? Where did this come from?
I don't know. I'm so confused after all the pizza I've eaten. So I give it a... give it a try.
This is what gluten does. So, Jimmy, you've been here a couple years now. Erica, new to the state.
Yep.
Pizza, you finding what you're looking for here?
You want to take that, boss?
She's really diplomatic.
I did not realize that there was a specific style of pizza to this area. So it's been an adventure exploring this and learning more from Jimmy, really.
Now, pizza is, of course, everywhere, but even the ubiquitous American food has some regional flavor. Let's hear Jimmy's story.
Hello?
This is Matthew Jones from Hudson. He and I share a common beef with the state, a serious lack of great pizza.
And I actually just had pizza for lunch.
Oh, I hope it was good.
It was average.
I know how you feel.
He wrote to us with a question about New Hampshire pizza.
I guess it's kind of two questions, really. Why does every town have a house of pizza? And why is every house of pizza almost exclusively the Greek-style pizza?
If you've ever had pizza in New Hampshire, there's a good chance that the pizza that you ate was Greek pizza. You may not have even known it. But if you've lived elsewhere, you probably recognize the difference. Greek pizza is traditionally cooked in a shallow pan, and its crust is kind of chewy like focaccia bread, too thick to be a thin crust, and too thin to be a deep dish. According to many food writers, one of the problems with Greek pizza is that it's quintessential mediocre pizza, and there's a steep curve to making it great. Matthew's favorite food writer, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, takes on Greek pizza in an infamous article. In it, he's got this quote that speaks to the universality of the food. Pizza is like sex. Even when it's bad, it's good.
He actually has this other quote. There's a reason that Greek-style pizza isn't more popular nationwide. It's just because it isn't very good. And I hate to be so mean about it, but it's just, you know, kind of the truth.
Matthew's originally from Pittsburgh, PA, and spent a handful of years in New Jersey. But his concern isn't isolated to transplants. Ask people what their favorite pizza place is. You might find, like I have, that there's a lot of indecision. You might get answers like whatever's closest or whoever delivers the latest.
So I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Like, why is this, out of all the pizza this region could have adopted, why Greek pizza?
that's great. I'm really happy that someone's kind of looking into this, because you can Google it and there's almost nothing.
To start, I needed to figure out if every town really has a house of pizza. So I went to a man who knows a thing about facts.
Okay, all right, Jimmy, let's talk about pizza here. I'm going to show you how many houses of pizza there actually are in New Hampshire.
This is NHPR's news director, Dan Barrick.
So if you go to the state of New Hampshire's website, there's a place where you can actually search by business name. You can look up any business name in the state. And you can actually do it just by term. So if you go to the site and type in under business name, you want something that contains the phrase house of pizza, and look.
All right, it's searching.
Spinning.
Spinning, spinning.
It's going to pull up a list that includes 276 business names that include the phrase house of pizza. A lot of these are duplications, like maybe some went out of business or they moved address, but 276, that's a lot of pizza.
And so how many towns are there in New Hampshire?
There's like 220-ish towns in New Hampshire, so, you know, there's a house of pizza for everyone out there.
Oh my gosh. And how do you feel about Greek pizza?
I'll take it. I mean, it's I'm from New York, and it's sort of the similar kind of pizza. It's, you know, I don't know.
You're being very diplomatic
here. It's very predictable. But there's some comfort in that, too, I think, for some people. You know, if you go into a house of pizza, it's going to be kind of oily. The crust is not going to be too thin, not too thick. It's going to be round. So
it's good for old people.
Kids, too.
Kids.
I mean, I've never had a kid turn down a piece of pizza.
But who decided that Greek pizzerias would all be called blank house of pizza? And why?
That's house pizza. House of Pizza. House of Pizza, pick up delivery.
Mermaid House of Pizza, can I help you?
Hey there, I was just curious, why is it called House of Pizza?
What do you mean?
Because it's made out of pizza.
Because this is the first pizza place since in the beginning of Epsom.
I'm really not too sure. Hold on one second.
House of Pizza meat.
It's more like a home type of deal, like come to our house, you know?
Typically, back in the day, House of Pizzas were owned by Greeks.
Yeah, I think typically house of pizzas are like Greek style.
Every town you'll notice has a house of pizza.
I have noticed. Okay, I was really curious.
Well, I'm glad I could help you.
All right, thanks. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
For some clearer answers, I'm going to have to go out of state for this one.
I'm Liz Barrett Foster. I'm an editor with PMQ Pizza Magazine.
No, you're not dreaming. There's a pizza magazine.
I also wrote a book called Pizza, A Slice of American History. It's all about the history of American pizza styles.
Liz says that before understanding how we got to House of Pizzas all over the place, we need a little pizza history. While pizza reverence is in question today, she says that wasn't always the case.
When the Italians came over
around the late 19th century,
it mostly stayed in their neighborhoods and things like that, but then history says that when the soldiers went to Italy, they gained a new appreciation for pizza. And then when they all came back and drove
post-World War II,
they still wanted that flavor. They wanted that pizza. And little did they know that it was already over here.
Before long, pizza ovens gave way to mass pizza production. And soon after, pizza chains started popping up all over the place. Regions had also started defining themselves with their own style of pie. Think about the popular styles you've probably heard of. There's New York style, Chicago deep dish, Detroit and St. Louis style. These are places that were hubs for Italian immigrants back in the day. Pizza distinguishes itself by a bunch of things like crust styles, sauces, how they're cooked. Altogether, Liz says there's close to 30 variations. Which gets us back to what exactly does House of Pizza mean and why are there so many in New Hampshire?
House of Pizza, what we found in that research, is it supposed to be a Greek restaurant? Usually you'll find, amongst other things, like spanakopita and the stuffed olive leaves and things that are Greek, but you find other things too, you know, like Greek pizza and burgers, I mean, all kinds of things, but it's called a house of pizza.
Okay, so house of pizza signals a Greek restaurant, which makes some sense since two of the main touchdowns for Greek immigrants in the 20th century were Metro New York and Boston. But there were also Italians in these communities already making pizza, really good pizza, like Neapolitan style. So how did Greek pizza become our regional pizza?
The Italians were the ones that were making all the pizza, and then according to that book that we saw, it showed that they ended up selling the pizza to the Greeks.
At the time, Italian families were more established and wanted to move on to full-service restaurants or start new careers altogether.
And after World War II, like 70% of Greek immigrants were running pizzerias. And I have to assume that they renamed them all House of Pizza.
Leaving New Hampshire with lots and lots of Greek pizza. But as someone who I'd call a pizza connoisseur or pizza aficionado, I had one more question. What is your take on Greek pizza?
I mean, when I've had it, it's okay. I mean, it's not really my favorite. I wouldn't, necessarily go seeking it out.
But I want to. I want to find some Greek pizza that puts a Jones in my bones for it. And I know it's not everyone's favorite, but it's clearly working for a lot of people. And then I found it. I found a House of Pizza with Google and Yelp reviews through the roof. A House of Pizza that's won WMUR's Viewer's Choice Award for Best Pizza the last 3 years in a row.
Let me grab this right here. My name is Tom Castagianis, one of the owners of Tilton House of Pizza. And we're at Tilton House of Pizza in Tilton, New Hampshire.
Katsagiannis family has been making pizza in Tilton for 20 years. The space feels like a mix between a cafeteria meets a family restaurant. There's a jukebox, arcade area, and hanging off the wall are old photos of New Hampshire landscape and Boston sports teams. Walking in leads you straight to the open kitchen with bar top seating, which is currently secured by a few regulars. Tom tells me what really sets Tilton House of Pizza apart is family.
Yep, I've got my brother John, who's he's on the sandwich unit. We have our dad out back, who takes care of the sauces, the cheese, and everything else that needs to be prepped out back. Our mom comes in the morning. She does prepping, helps out herself, and then we have another brother that comes out that helps as well at night. So
he says his typical work week runs anywhere from 70 to 80 hours per week. But for his parents, who immigrated from Greece to Manchester in the 70s, this is everything they could have hoped for.
When they moved to Manchester, went and worked at the mills, like every pretty much Greek immigrant did back in the day, in the shoe textile business, and then decided they wanted to do something more appealing. They wanted to get into the pizza business.
They opened up their first pizzeria in Manchester in 1990. At the time, Tom was in high school.
I remember being young, getting out of school, going right to the shop and doing our homework and helping out around the shop and going home and then waking up next day doing it all over again.
They start the day by making dough from scratch. Then it's sauce time and mixing their three cheese blend. Every step is supervised by a family member. Today, on one side of Tom is this pizza oven conveyor belt. On the other side, a bunch of naked pies sitting in pans just waiting for toppings. After he dresses them to order, they go into the conveyor oven for about 10 minutes at 500 degrees. Then they're finished off in a brick oven without the pan.
Beautiful. See the cheese nice and melted?
Oh my gosh.
Well, and beautiful.
Those colors are so perfect.
Absolutely.
It looks and smells like award-worthy pizza. I asked Tom if there's a stigma attached to the name House of Pizza.
Actually, we take pride in a couple of things. We take pride that we've had those that, we've heard, they say we've driven by you 100 times. Just never thought. We thought that House of Pizza is just a typical House of Pizza. This one person lived in town for about a dozen years before he tried us out, and now he's in here 2 to 3 times a week.
While there are a lot of House of Pizzas in the state, that doesn't mean that there's not great pizza to be had. It's also a pretty solid reminder that New Hampshire's regional pizza isn't just food. It's a story of who we are and where we've come from.
That story was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez for our Only in New Hampshire series. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. So we in journalism talk a lot about the principle of objectivity. And Erica, I've been told that when Jimmy first showed you his draft of this story, you were a little worried about his overtly anti-Greek pizza, can I call it bias?
Yeah, I was a little bit concerned. I mean, I understand that, you know, we all have our personal tastes, but I also was like, there must be people that really like this. And I bet that these are family-owned businesses, and I just didn't, you know, people are pouring their hearts into these things, whether you like it or not. And so I just wanted to be a little bit respectful of that.
That's a good editor. Because I did not have that intuition at all. I did. But no, the more that I looked into it and, you know, this idea of objectivity, we're talking about food, right? The folks that I went to, and I would go onto their writings or musings on Greek pizza or pizza just in general, they did not give high marks to Greek pizza. As a matter of fact, I think that if they heard the piece, they would think that I was actually, I took it easy on Greek pizza. And I will say, to your point, like, we did find some amazing families that we were able to profile that do it right, that really do put a lot into it. And it does make the pie better.
Yeah, I definitely think. I think one of the conversations that Jimmy and I had about this after that first draft is just thinking about this is an immigration story, and that the regional style of pizza reflects the people who settled there. So whether you like it or not, I think it adds something to it to just know that the reason our pizza looks and tastes the way that it does is because of the people that came to settle here.
It's a real deep dish of a story.
Jimmy, you brought it around again. So we did air this pizza segment, and we asked listeners to chime in with their favorite pizza joints. What did we hear back, Jimmy?
Okay, so a couple comments. These were online. Stew, which I'm not sure if Stew was a plant from Taylor or a pseudonym for Taylor, because Taylor always talks up Market Basket pizzas. And Stew talked about how much he loved the Market Basket pizza with the real brick oven, New York style, fresh, round, thin crust. And then also Tom wrote us talking about Piccolo's Market in Moultonboro.
Now, he said he was a New Yorker.
He said he's a New York transplant, and he talked to the owner, and he's like, hey, like, I love your pizza. It really, like, captures the New York essence. And the owner's like, well, it should, because I'm a New Yorker.
Didn't we get a call from, who was the woman who called us?
And we got a voicemail, too.
This is Shelby Mabel. My favorite pizza place is Alley Cat Pizza in Manchester, New Hampshire. After going to college in Manchester and eating that many, many nights in a row, nothing compares to Alley Cat Pizza. I could eat a white cat every day of the week. Thank you.
Thank you, Shelby. I have to think. I don't think I was such a discerning pizza eater in college.
I think Shelby's
white,
got a
red cheese
case of nostalgia on that one. It could be great, though. Who knows?
Well, Jimmy, I honestly do hope that you find your dependable go-to slice soon.
Dear God, me too. Thank you, Virginia.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You heard our tagline, your questions answered, your state explored. And that's kind of the bread and butter of our Only in New Hampshire series, where you ask about the habits and the mysterious relics and the generally ungoogleable things about New Hampshire, and we send our producers out into the world to do a little detective work. In the studio with me today is our executive producer, Erica Janik.
Hello.
And producer Justine Paradise.
Oh, hey.
So, Justine, you got handed a really big question. A listener wanted to know why New Hampshire is so opposed to a broad-based income or sales tax. Now, this is interesting because it's not necessarily asking about the politics of taxes today, but how did we get here, this vehement, flat-out opposition?
I love these sort of historical stories because I think when you live in a place, it's really easy to take the status quo, the everyday, for granted without ever really thinking about why and how. How did we end up here? And I have to say, as someone who's new to New Hampshire, the anti-tax thing is something I knew about New Hampshire before coming here. So I loved learning more about where this came from. And it was a really great story from Justine.
And it's a really great story for someone who grew up here and it was just part of the air. So we're going to play a little excerpt from the story. Justine, can you kind of set it up for us?
Sure. So in this bit, you're going to hear from three very different people. There's Arnie Arneson, who's a radio show host and former Democratic candidate for governor.
My name is Arnie Arneson. I describe myself as a politician in recovery.
And then there's Joe McQuaid, the publisher of The Union Leader.
I think, speaking of DNA, we should make everybody in the state of New Hampshire take a spit test. And anybody who's in favor of a broad-based tax, they're going to have to go someplace else.
And then there's Brad Cook, who's the lawyer and a longtime political columnist.
And I've been involved with New Hampshire Public Affairs way back since 1966.
All three of them, Arnie, Joe, and Brad, told me that you just can't tell the story of New Hampshire and taxes without talking about this one guy, William Loeb.
Well, before Fox, before social media, before cable TV, we had William Loeb. And William Loeb was the publisher of the most powerful statewide newspaper called the Union Leader.
William Loeb was, from 1946 until 1981, a pretty influential figure in the state of New Hampshire.
No media source in New Hampshire has the dominance that the Union Leader had when he was the owner.
It's hard to overstate. New Hampshire today would just not be the same without the influence of William Loeb. He was very conservative and one of the most powerful figures in the state for 35 years, and he got his fair share of national attention, too. By 1948, Loeb had bought and combined New Hampshire's two major newspapers. So the Union Leader was born. Loeb had a media monopoly in the state. But he didn't live in New Hampshire.
He was not a New Hampshireite.
He and his wife had a place in Massachusetts, but they were legal residents of Reno, Nevada.
But we were his political petri dish.
He ran the paper in a very controversial and colorful way.
And he always wore a bow tie or a bolo tie. After he realized that the national press was writing about him because he was such a flamethrower, that's when he decided to have an editorial every day of the week except for Sundays.
Three times I had editorials. One favorable, two unfavorable.
He was unapologetic. Here's Loeb discussing his editorial and why he thought black people are inferior to white people. This is from a PBS documentary on his life.
Let me put it this way. How come in all these years in a perfectly decent climate in Africa, they hardly even developed the wheel?
What's an example of his influence?
Well, the one that you're here for, the lack of a broad-based tax in the state of New Hampshire. I think William Loeb had a great deal to do with that.
Oh, he was absolutely against broad-based taxes.
He thought that the more money you give to the government, the more the government will expand and spend. Our cartoonist back in the day, we had a character known as Old Broadbase, which was a big money bag with big eyes and mother tattooed on one arm and bleed 'em dry tattooed on the other.
What would he do if he had like a pet issue or something that he wanted to happen?
He'd pound it every day, every day. He could take something and make it an issue. You wouldn't have heard of the pledge if he didn't keep pounding it all the time.
But William Loeb didn't invent New Hampshire's anti-tax attitude. The belief in limited government has deep roots. Brad Cook says it dates back all the way to New Hampshire's colonial constitution, written in 1776, right after the beginning of the American Revolution.
Our government is weak by design, diffuse by design. The people who wrote our constitution made sure we had a big house, a small senate, a two-year term for governors, so that there wouldn't be a strong central government.
On top of that, income taxes in the United States are only about a century old. It was only after the 16th Amendment passed in 1913 that the federal government was even allowed to collect taxes off income. But when it was first proposed 2 years earlier, in 1911, New Hampshire rejected it. And when the amendment did pass, New Hampshire was the last state to ratify it. After the federal government, states started implementing income taxes too, but New Hampshire wasn't among them. As the New York Times reported in 1929, New Hampshire manifests small enthusiasm for an income tax. But that wasn't true across the board. In 1949, Governor Sherman Adams proposed an income tax, and in the late 60s, moderate Republican Walter Peterson decided to take on the tax code, which hadn't changed very much since the 19th century agrarian economy. There were a lot of old, creaky taxes on the books, like the stock-and-trade tax that would levy a tax on inventory. Peterson hoped to clean house, but in 1971, he also proposed a 3% income tax, which drew the ire of William Loeb.
In a way, the problem for Walter Peterson was Bill Loeb.
During election times, he would whack the candidates he didn't like and promote the candidates he did like in no uncertain terms. no varnish. He is famous or infamous for calling various presidents of the United States the number one liar in the United States. That would be John F. Kennedy.
Dopey Dwight.
That would be former General Eisenhower.
He allegedly made Ed Muskie cry, with some people credited with Muskie losing to McGovern.
John Kennedy, the night before the general election in 1960, had a big rally across the street from the Union leader. And Kennedy got up and said, "There may be a worse newspaper and a worse publisher in these United States than the Union leader in William Loeb. But if there are, I can't think of them right now." And William Loeb said, "He gets upset with a little old newspaper publisher in New Hampshire says, I wouldn't want him in a White House."
William Loeb had been propping up candidates and tearing down others for years, but none with more success than Meldrum Thompson Jr.
Mel said he was out haying his field one day and got off the tractor and filed for governor.
What was his slogan again?
Axe the tax.
Axe the tax. And somebody gave him an axe handle and he carried it around in his car. I don't think he ever committed mayhem with it. So Mel Thompson and Loeb were sort of kismet.
So Governor Peterson had been reforming the tax system and entertaining the idea of an income tax. And Thompson was saying,
"You're like me, that's not going to happen." We did, and it didn't.
It took three tries, but in 1972, Mel Thompson beat Walter Peterson for the Republican primary. Then he was elected governor. Mel Thompson was a very conservative, fiery character. He was notorious for inflammatory positions like suggesting that the National Guard carry nuclear weapons or lobbying for an oil refinery on the seacoast. Loeb remained a close friend and probably an advisor. They called each other all the time.
They were friends and they went mountain climbing together along with their wives, Gail Thompson and Naki Loeb.
Even New Hampshire's state motto wasn't widespread until Mel Thompson's tenure. The Live Free or Die song you've been hearing comes from Keep New Hampshire Number One, a 45 filled with songs pressed for Mel Thompson's campaign for a third term in 1976. A lot of what is considered intrinsic to New Hampshire today comes from the era of Mel Thompson and William Loeb, and that includes the anti-tax pledge.
Well, yeah, did he invent the pledge, Loeb?
Oh, God, yes. Well, I don't know if Loeb did or Mel did. I mean, it's kind of a cocktail. And what is so amazing is that the ghost of Mel and Bill is still so present today.
What changed was momentum to change the tax system was halted.
Any candidate for governor would be asked, and if nobody else asked, we would make sure that our reporter asked, "Are you taking the pledge?"
I mean, he'd want to know if somebody running for alderman in Ward 1 in Manchester was taking the pledge. Well, last I checked, they couldn't pass a bread-based tax, but he'd ask about it. Executive counselors who can't vote on a bread-based tax, he'd want to know if they were taking the pledge. I mean, it became something that candidates would say, just let's get it out of the way.
Hugh Gallon beat Mel Thompson, and Hugh Gallon took the pledge. So did John Sununu. So did Judd Gregg. So did John Lynch, so did Craig Benson, so did Gene Shaheen the first couple of times.
So it stopped being just a litmus test in the Republican Party. It became a litmus test in both parties.
It's just so well ingrained in the state that retired teachers from Maryland know about it. That's great. That's the best news I've heard all day.
But it's not like New Hampshire could never change. The last state to implement an income tax was Connecticut in 1991. It was the 41st state to do so, but it was a controversial move. At the time, some politicians promised property tax relief would also come along, but that didn't pan out. Now, Connecticut has both an income tax and high local property taxes, and it consistently ranks among the highest tax states in the country. For some in New Hampshire, Connecticut is a cautionary tale. And some say New Hampshire's tax system is working, like Jared Walczak at the Tax Foundation in Washington, D.C., which rates New Hampshire as number 7 on its state business tax climate index. When I called him, Jared Walczak said that there is something to the idea of the New Hampshire advantage.
New Hampshire has the reputation generally as a low tax state, and that, therefore it makes the state fairly attractive for investment and for people to locate their activities in. And the state has done well for itself over the years. If you look regionally, especially when you look at the demographics of the state, you know, you see a state that has been probably punching above its weight for a long time.
But back to our listener, Mary Douglas, and her question. The fact that it feels impossible to even discuss tax reform doesn't sit well with a lot of people, including Arnie Arneson. She's not sure about the idea that the state is working just fine without any broad-based taxes.
Working for whom? So the fact that we have some success, and we do, don't get me wrong, we also have the highest, we're one of the oldest states in the nation. So as we age, and as we claim we're working, let's start looking at the people that aren't successful. Let's start looking at the communities that aren't thriving. We're not a state without taxes. We're a state with some of the highest fees, the highest student tuition costs.
Arneson also pointed to the opioid crisis. New Hampshire has the third highest rate of opioid deaths in the country, but ranks lowest in New England in treatment programs per capita. In 2012, voters in New Hampshire got a chance to weigh in on whether a state income tax should ever be a possibility here. There was a referendum on the ballot proposing a constitutional amendment to never implement a state income tax. The referendum won 57% of the vote, but it didn't pass. It needed two-thirds.
Justine Paradise produced that piece for Olin in New Hampshire. This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. So because William Loeb and Meldrum Thompson have both passed away, this story used some archival tape. And to pull the curtain back a bit, there was some debate over how much of William Loeb's tape to use. I mean, Erica, what was the question there?
So there's some really bad tape, bad in the sense of the content of it, of William Loeb saying some really racist stuff. And we really debated over what our duty was of revealing, you know, all of his inflammatory positions. And we, you know, we wanted to acknowledge that this is who this guy is, but we also didn't want it to distract from the tax question that we were really trying to answer in this story.
So this is a clip of stuff you didn't play?
We played a part of this clip.
So tell us about what we're going to be hearing.
So we decided to play a little piece of this clip. We just played a fragment of it. And so this is the sort of the full context, which is it's from a PBS documentary, Powerful as the Truth, which is the union leader headline. You know, it was hard to find audio of Thompson and Loeb because this was sort of pre-NPR. Mm-hmm. It was pre-internet. So a lot of this stuff is kind of is hard to find. So this was from Powerful as the Truth, an interview between a journalist who's reading back to Loeb an editorial that he's written. And then Loeb responds after that.
It is, however, in the opinion of this newspaper, typical of the savagery of some of the blacks in this country. They hate whites. They are without any moral restraint. They have no more feeling for a situation like this, apparently, than jungle savages from the darkest parts of Africa. It is because this newspaper wants to avoid this type of thing happening in New Hampshire that we are hopeful that the black population of New Hampshire will never increase from its present minimal figure. I ask you if you think we can ever solve the racial dilemma of this country if strong language and bitterness like this exist.
Yes, I think you can. I wouldn't back off one inch from that, and I'll tell you why. Many of them are just like children, unfortunately. This is not an environmental problem. This is a really genetic problem. This is not their fault anymore. It is the fault of the Aborigines in Australia. They're years back in the evolution and development.
You believe that?
I really believe that.
Can you offer any documentation? You're right.
Let me put it this way. How come in all these years in a perfectly decent climate in Africa, they hardly even developed the wheel?
I'm speechless. When you were doing research on William Loeb, did that level and racist conviction come up when you were looking at his legacy? I mean, you know, like a Wikipedia page, which is how many people would learn.
No, not like that. The only place I've heard it to that degree is in that documentary, which is freely available and we link to it. It's funky because this is sort of in the air of how New Hampshire was shaped for decades, but you know, finding kind of evidence of that is hard. We know that he was, he made a really strong point to prove that he wasn't Jewish. He produced his birth certificate in New Hampshire to prove that he wasn't a Jew.
When you're hearing this tape, I feel like people should know who this man was.
Yeah, and that was part of the decision that we made to air just a piece of that. So we did want to acknowledge that this is also who he is.
Well, you run into this a lot, like what is the real story? And when you are talking about people who have maybe problematic views, that when does that come into a story? How do you write it in? And it's something we discuss a lot. So,
yep.
Justine, thank you for sharing the story and for all your work on this. I know it was significant.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks, Erica.
Thank you.
Word of Mouth was produced today by Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Justine Paradise. Our staff also includes Hannah McCarthy. Erica Janik is executive producer, and Maureen McMurray is director of Clip Show Integration. Music from Jazar, Ketza, Ari De Niro, Blue Dot Sessions, and Poddington Bear. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.